level. At this hour, the corridor was deserted. Alex slid down to the deck, and Julian joined him. "You've not been yourself lately, Julian," Alex said. "Not much repartee between you and me, and you've exhibited a lack of patience with the young ones. What's on your mind?" Julian raced through a nearly innumerable list of potential answers, and then he halted all kernel response activity. "When did I start conditioning my replies to Alex?" the Sayd asked himself. "The data we're collecting on the Nual indicate they're more formidable and dangerous than we could have perceived," Julian replied. "We've been seeing this coming for a while, Julian. Why the change in your attitude now?" Julian reached back through his memories from the moment of his inception to the present and considered the reasons for his algorithm's priorities. "When all you perceive is an endless repeat of your days, there's not much to hold dear for the future," Julian replied. "Without hope, dreams dwindle and die." "And now?" Alex asked, realizing Julian was referring to the period before he was freed from his box. "Year after year, for more than 2 decades, my future has grown richer. For all the processing power I possess, I couldn't have imagined the life I have today, and I owe its start to you." "I thank you for that thought, Julian, but you've given me as much as I've given you." "I would deem it impossible to compare our lives, Alex. They are what they are. What's important is our future, and I sense that it grows short for both of us. Humans and Sayds represent a small population. The probabilities are high that we won't be able to compete against the likes of an ancient and vast alien civilization." "Who says we have to compete?" Alex replied. "You, my friend, are holding on to the moment too tightly. That has to restrict your thinking." "What are your intentions, if not to compete, Alex?" "Julian, how great would you estimate the Nual territory to be?" "If I were to extrapolate from the wall's curvature and form a virtual sphere, it would encompass thousands of stars, possibly more than 10,000. "And how many races do you think the Nual subsumed during their expansion?" Alex asked. "That would be impossible to calculate, Alex, but certainly numerous intelligent species were either co-opted or destroyed." "And how many races do you think came knocking on their hatch?" Julian had to smile at the question. "The probabilities are that it's only one, led by a foolish human." "And what do you think this ancient race will think of a species that doesn't exhibit fear at the sight of them, has destroyed 2 of their spheres and not only located their hidden probes but destroyed them? A civilization this old would have a well-established order, and we would be disturbing it." "One last question, my friend. What do you think is the ultimate purpose of the probes?" "Ah, an easy one," Julian replied. "The Nual have taken the long view. They're keeping an eye on worlds with developing species, and they're sending out spheres to remove any races that have attained or are capable of attaining space travel. The Confederation encompassed the first human worlds to attract their attention, and most likely our starships were death sentences for our colonies." "Now, Julian, I want you to believe that you won't live to see Omnia again, so that your mind is clear of worry about the future. How would you put all this together?" "The Nual have size and power on their side, but they'll have become accustomed to having their way. Everything and everyone has succumbed to their advance. We show up, disrupting their habits, their protocols, which will confound them. They'll want a closer examination." Alex raised an eyebrow as if to say, "Precisely." Julian smiled in return. "We'll intimidate them with our single ship, sitting stationary at the edge of their territory, and they'll be asking themselves endless questions and debating possible actions before they decide what to do." "We don't have a choice, Julian," We can't move our populations, and we can't wait until the spheres arrive en masse at our systems. Like you say, the Nual have the power. That means that we have to be clever and proactive. Julian nodded in agreement and said, "And if I'm to be of help, then I must accept that the future is unknown, and be at ease with what I have attained."
"Just so," Alex replied.
Julian stood and extended a hand, easily helping Alex to his feet. "You will have my every ability, Alex. Of course it will be difficult to follow you, as I lack the benefit of your formal jester training." Julian's hand was locked on Alex's when he froze. "We have company, Alex. Third Watch is notifying the captain. I suggest we attain the bridge." By the time Alex and Julian walked through the bridge passageway, Ellie was present, buttoning her jacket and smoothing her short hair. The holovid displayed several ships. "The telemetry view is pushed in for a close-up, Alex," Ellie said. "They're a long way out and decelerating rapidly." "Continuing their present rate of deceleration, Alex, these ships will come to a stop an estimated 20 million kilometers from us," Julian said.
"They're being cautious," Alex said, grinning at Julian.
Julian caught Ellie's quizzical expression, and he sent privately to her, "Moments ago, our fearless leader and I were speaking. We were supposing the reactions of the Nual to our provocation. It was the jester who proposed that we would confound an ancient race with our absurd stance."
"Who was playing the part of the jester?" Ellie asked.
"It used to be me, Captain, but I admit to having recently abdicated my post. However, I've chosen to regain my title," Julian sent. A jacquard print cap, peaking in a small gold sphere, appeared and disappeared so quickly from Julian's head that Ellie wasn't sure what she saw until she replayed her visual recording.
"Welcome back, Julian," Ellie sent.
"Julian, my guess is that we would be signaled, or perhaps investigated in some manner," Alex mused.
"Undoubtedly," Julian replied.
"I'd like to capture the raw transmissions."
"Not recommended, Alex. Whatever we record will pass through our controller, and we have no idea of the enemy's signal capabilities. Conceivably, they could render our ship inoperable."
"What if we interrupted the signals directly after our comm receptors and delivered them to secondary memory crystals, thereby protecting our controller?"
"It's not like we need to talk to our people or them," Alex said, pointing at the display.
Julian grinned at Alex. He signaled 2 engineers and 3 techs, launching them from their bunks with orders to collect various pieces of equipment and tools. Then he ran from the bridge at a speed that shocked Ellie. He planned to meet the engineering team near the warship's aft end, where the main lines emerged from the comm equipment.
"That's quite the growing reception party," Ellie commented, nodding at the holovid.
Alex eyed the image. The ships were rapidly increasing in number and size.
"Captain, with Julian absorbed in my request, I want additional bridge crew woken up and searching our telemetry net. This main party is tucked much too tightly together out there. I believe they want us to think that's everyone that's coming, and I don't like that."
"Understood, Alex," Ellie replied tersely, waking most of the First Watch, including Yumi.
No sooner had the new watch group arrived than other crew members hurried in, carrying extra bridge chairs for them. Nanites in the seat bases were signaled, attaching them to the decking. Soon another group arrived, with pots of tea to refresh the third watch and waken the first. On the deck, 2 of the Trident techs were busy spreading a nanites paste to release a section of the bulkhead. This allowed the engineering team to access a tertiary memory bank, which was available to the controller but had never been used. Julian isolated the memory core from the controller. Then, when an engineer signaled Julian that they had access to the comm cabling, the Sage shut down the power to the comm station.
Immediately, the techs accessed a junction line and rerouted the main comm signal to a converter box they had brought with them. The device was needed to interface between the comm station and the memory bank. Finally, they connected the output of the converter to the memory bank's input. When Julian received a tech's acknowledgement that the crew were ready, he returned power to the comm station and requested the crew reseal the bulkhead cutout. "Alex," Julian sent, "the comm station is prepared to feed the memory crystals. Recognize that if we launch the travelers, they'll be unable to communicate with us."
"Understood, Julian. The captain has played with scenarios that launch the travelers, but I have no intention of allowing them to exit this ship."
"Captain," a bridge crew member called out, attracting Alex's attention away from Julian, "I have a large vessel on our horizon. The ship is located 90 degrees to port. It's about the same distance out as the main group."
"Captain, another ship. It's also on the horizontal plane, but 90 degrees to starboard," a second crew member announced.
"Just the one ship in each location?" Ellie asked, and received affirmatives. During the next several hours, more of the enormous ships appeared, dividing the quadrants of space and surrounding the Trident warship.
"Captain, I don't get this," Yumi said, standing close to Ellie so that she could whisper.
"The Nual can't be so foolish as to think they can cut off our escape by positioning single ships every 45 degrees of arc around us like this."
"That's because they aren't single ships, as you imagine them," Alex said, coming from behind Yumi.
"No?" Yumi queried.
"More than likely, Lieutenant, they're carriers," Ellie said.
"Julian," Alex sent, "any idea as to whether we're recording Nual comm or telemetry detection signals?"
"I've been monitoring the interface device, Alex, purely in a passive mode," Julian hurriedly sent to assure Alex. "I estimate that the memory crystals are about 19% full."
"Already?" Alex responded.
"Our neighbors appear to be quite voluble, or their transmission technology requires a much greater data density than ours."
"Captain, the timing of our exit is now in your hands," Alex said. "One condition and one request. The condition is that you can't launch the fighters. The request is that you allow our memory core to record the Nual transmissions as long as possible, without jeopardizing our opportunity for escape."
"Did I ever tell you, Alex, that your captains and senior commanders, including myself, are often particularly annoyed by your convoluted directives?"
"Seriously?" Alex asked, grinning at Ellie, who ignored him as she tapped her third watch pilot on the shoulder.
"Yumi, take a seat. I want options for exit, and I want them fast. Plan for those capital ships dumping out some sort of fighters and spreading a wide net," Ellie ordered.
Alex linked to the controller to watch Yumi sort through her escape scenarios. It appeared she'd planned for enemy strategies Alex hadn't considered. A brilliant mind, he thought. Yumi selected the few scenarios that responded to a wide arc of coverage by the Nual. She was about to speak to Ellie, but several crew members on telemetry watch interrupted her as they sang out, "Fighters launched!" The holovid display lit up, detecting hundreds and hundreds of fighters dumping out of the enormous ships that sought to enclose them.
1,315 fighters and counting, Julian announced.
"Time to go, Yumi," Ellie said quietly but with authority. "Don't be afraid to take a radical approach."
The one thing that Edward and Miko constantly said about their daughter was that she had an uncanny means of seeing to the heart of a problem. Now more than ever, Yumi wanted to call on that ability. Observing the three-quarter sphere of fighters that blocked their escape in Omnia's direction, Yumi selected a vector and accelerated the Trident at full power. Ellie, Alex, and Julian observed their warship rush toward the central greeting party. They exchanged glances, and Alex cocked an eyebrow at Ellie.
"Interesting choice, Lieutenant," Ellie said. "Care to explain your tactic?"
"Yes, Captain," Yumi replied, concentrating on her board display and her link with the controller. I realized that the enemy assumed we would only choose to flee away from that massive fleet in front of us. That's why they didn't bother to completely surround us with fighters.
The size and number of those ships in front of us would seem to indicate that they're not worried about a single ship charging them, Ellie commented.
And I thought about that too, Captain, Yumi replied. I took a few moments to review the arrival of the main party. What was interesting was that as the larger vessels arrived, they formed a hollow ball, which I thought was strange. Then the last ship arrived. I was surprised to see that it was a small sphere. Interestingly, Captain, that sphere stationed itself in the center of that formation. It's about 25 meters in diameter and doesn't appear to have any armament.
Curious, Ellie commented.
That's what I thought, Captain, Yumi replied. Which led me to wonder, is that fleet in front of us designed to intimidate us or to protect those aboard the sphere?
Those ships could be doing both, Lieutenant, Ellie purposed.
I agree, Captain, but I decided a rearward exit had little chance of success. The number of fighters dumping out of those carriers limits our avenues of escape, and we have no idea of the armament they possess. Worse, we'd be targeting small ships one by one with our beams, while the vast majority of them would be targeting us from all directions.
And we'd run the power crystals empty against a multitude of little targets and be swamped by the others, Ellie finished for Yumi.
Exactly, Captain, Yumi replied.
A rearward exit wasn't a viable option. That left the front. I'm betting on those aboard that small sphere worrying that we're coming for them. And maybe, just maybe, they're thinking that we're capable of doing the same thing as their sphere did when we cornered it.
Meaning we don't have to fight our way through to that orb. We only have to get close and detonate our ship, Ellie supplied.
Yumi nodded, immersed in making a subtle course correction.
The small sphere had shifted laterally inside its protective environment, possibly checking to see if the foreign warship was targeting it. Yumi's new vector kept the Liberator traveling straight at it. Time ticked down as the Trident raced forward. Nerves tightened further. A crew member who was estimating the distance the warship had covered to the waiting fleet said, 35%.
Movement, Captain, Julian said quietly.
The ships in front of us are retreating. What's of note is that they're not breaking formation, and the sphere remains in the center of the protective shield.
Excellent analysis, Lieutenant, Alex said. It appears those ships were there primarily to protect the orb.
Telemetry detected the main party continuing to accelerate. They were in full retreat. Yumi waited until her warship had closed the distance to approximately 50% of the way. This ensured that the enemy retreat was well underway and she'd cleared the fighter's partial sphere. Then Yumi arced the Trident up, taking a line between the main party and the carrier fighter forces. Yumi continued to drive the Trident at full power, monitoring the engine's statuses. She needn't have worried on that score. Nearly every bridge crew member, not occupied with monitoring telemetry for more enemy ships, was eyeing those readouts.
"We're well inside Nual territory," Julian sent to Alex.
And isn't it interesting that they weren't prepared for this eventuality, especially from a lone ship, Alex sent in reply.
Yumi was clever and proactive, Julian commented, repeating the words Alex had spoken to him.
Well done, everyone, Alex said, applauding the bridge crew and Julian. The holovid indicated that Yumi's continuing arc would eventually allow the Liberator to make a complete course reversal, far over top of the fighter shield. Better yet, none of the enemy ships were pursuing them.
Turning to Julian, Alex asked, "How did we do on the comm memory?"
"Nearly 3/5 full, Alex," Julian replied, smiling and displaying his trademark fedora.
"My friend is back," Alex sent to Julian,
laying a hand on the Sade's shoulder before gently squeezing. Chapter 32. Return Home. When the Liberator exited into Omnian space, Alex chose to stay off the comm, while the crew taxed the warship's bandwidth with a mountain of messages and comm links. After the Liberator had left the Nual fleet far behind, Julian and the engineering team had reversed their surgery on the comm station linkage. At one point, Julian had suggested to Alex that he investigate what the memory crystals had stored. "Absolutely not," Alex had replied, horrified. "Didn't you tell me that the Nual could produce deviant signals, which would be a primary concern for the ship's controller?" "Yes, but I'm much more sophisticated than a ship's controller," Julian had replied. "Granted," Alex replied, "but that might not be enough." "Your concern for me is touching," Julian said with a lift of his eyebrows. "It's no such thing," Alex replied offhand. "I'm concerned that we've come all this way to observe the Nual reaction to our presence and capture their broadcasts, and if you go tinkering about with the information, we might lose it." Julian had laughed at Alex's excuse and decided to leave well enough alone. When Alex pinged the warship's comm bandwidth and found it at less than half capacity, he linked to the Freedom. "Welcome back, Alex," Cordelia replied. "It's good to be back, Cordelia," Alex sent. "Mickey, please." "Alex, the taunter of great civilizations, returns home triumphant," Mickey announced. "Amusing, Mickey," Alex sent, his thought devoid of humor. "And to what do I owe the honor of this calm?" Mickey replied, unfazed by Alex's reaction. "How goes the work on the Freedom's armament?" "Oh, you mean the task that we completed 7 months ago? Fine." "Good, then you're free and bored, Mickey, waiting for a new one. This one might challenge you." "Ah, good, at least you've come home bearing gifts." Julian managed to deviate the comm station's reception of the Nual broadcast directly to Memory Crystal. "At present it's completely isolated, and I want it to remain that way. This is precious stuff, which needs analysis without risking ships or Sades." "Now that's a challenge. How much did you get?" "It's the Liberator's tertiary memory bank, and it's at 58.7% of capacity." "How much data was on it before you started recording, Alex?"
"It was empty, Mickey."
"How long were you exposed to the Nual fleet? I heard it was brief, but you're saying you have a half-full memory bank."
"It was hours, Mickey, not days. Start your transfer analysis design with your engineering team. I want complete isolation, backup copies, and techniques that protect the Sades. There's no telling what the Nual were capable of sending us that could corrupt programming. Remember, this wasn't a conversation between us and them. This was a one-way broadcast at our ship by the Nual for hours." Alex dropped the secondary link to Mickey and retained it with the Freedom.
"Who's next, Alex?" Cordelia asked.
"You, Cordelia," Alex replied. "Do you have any reports from Tatia Therese and Olawale?"
Cordelia had copious communications from the three individuals who Alex requested. The smallest group originated from Therese, and she summarized those for Alex while she worked on the next group.
"President Therese sent her wish to Omnia for your safe journey. I've taken the liberty of informing her of your return."
"Thank you, Cordelia."
"New Terra accepted Admiral Reynard's first offer," Cordelia continued. "The MT Tridents have been training at Harrikhan. Admiral Tachenko took the fleet to Bellamond, as you requested. She reported that in the first quarter, 23% of the new recruits resigned. It has since dropped off to less than 7% in the latest quarter. Also, she reports a significant improvement in the tactical performance of the captains,
and the Meridians are developing a strong rapport with her senior commanders.
Good to hear, Cordelia.
Of interest to me was Admiral Tachenko's report of the crew's favorite downtime efforts, Alex. They're helping the Sif repopulate the flora and fauna of the planet. They've rigged the fighters to disperse seeds in the areas designated by the SAIDs, and they manage the incubator pods that develop the new embryos. Once birthed, these faunas are introduced to the environment under controlled conditions.
Alex mulled over that one. He could imagine the individuals who participated in the Sif plan to restore Bellamond to a healthy planet experiencing emotionally cathartic events.
"And our friends at Sol?" Alex asked.
"There have been only three messages, Alex. Each was lengthy. Oluwale recorded his thoughts on a daily basis. Then he sent them on a quarterly basis."
Alex checked his calendar app. The length of time that the Reaver had been gone from Omnia, minus the initial travel time, said that there should have been a fourth report. In fact, a fifth would be due within little more than a month.
"Yes, Alex, his last report is overdue. However, I can set your mind to rest. His diaries, if I may call them that, detail great progress with the Earthers at all levels, government, military, and populace. If I can extrapolate from the rate and amount of entries, Oluwale and his team became increasingly busy."
"Understood, Cordelia. Thank you for your briefing. I'll send messages to all individuals."
The Liberator's crew was more than happy to decamp the warship and enjoy time off aboard the Freedom. Only a few individuals remained aboard when Mickey and his team arrived. Julian led them to the temporary bulkhead access, which had been opened again. "I recommend taking this converter with you, Mickey," Julian said. "It handled the flow of the Nual broadcast without interruption."
"Why do you think that was?" Mickey asked.
"Simplicity, Mickey. There was little programming for the broadcast to corrupt, if that was the intention of the Nual. It merely relays signals at a rudimentary level." Mickey grunted and indicated the device to a tech who set to work removing it.
"Did you sample the stream, Julian?" Mickey asked.
"I was forbidden to touch the data," Julian replied. Mickey lifted his head away from examining the tech's work to stare at Julian, several thoughts rushing through his mind.
"That scared of its potency, was he?" Mickey asked.
Julian shrugged his shoulders in reply.
"It's difficult to put close friends in harm's way," Mickey murmured.
When Mickey signaled Miriam that she was free to begin the transfer, the SAID carefully attached leads to the memory bank from a secondary power supply that resided in a large shipping crate. The Liberator's power supply was disconnected, and the memory bank was released from its containment facility. Carefully and slowly, Miriam transferred the crystals and their support parts to the crate. The two SAIDs sealed it and carried it to the waiting traveler. Miriam could have carried the crate herself without much challenge. However, when the SAIDs heard Mickey, who knew them well, repeat their instructions three times, they knew their operations must carry as close to zero risk as possible. They were taking all precautions to act accordingly. The traveler transferring the crate made planetfall, landing at one of Mickey's engineering labs outside Omnia City. It was a fairly isolated building. More important, Mickey and his team had the space to prepare a special lab. It was protected against every transmission that they could conceive. Furthermore, there were no cable connections or power from the lab to the outer rooms. The work lab was entirely self-contained, as far as any signal transmission was concerned. Mickey, the engineers, and the SAIDs had chosen to construct a set of controllers that were prepared to review, sample, and analyze the data. The idea was to connect the first controller to a single crystal of the memory bank with a cutout switch. The processed data would be held within the controller rather than be returned to the Trident's memory crystal. A small operations device received a link from the controller to record the steps that the controller took. It was considered a backup, which few thought necessary. When all was prepared, Miriam signaled Mickey and the remainder of the team assembled outside the lab. A simple switch was employed to start the operations. Mickey triggered a timer and exited the space. When the timer ended, the switch closed and completed the connection between the controller and the warship's memory crystal. Soon the team watched their first controller overheat and shut down, smoke pouring from its casing.
"Black space," Mickey whispered.
Miriam immediately sent an image to Julian. This happened within 0.075 hours after the controller began sampling the Nual broadcast.
"Set up the second controller," Mickey ordered the lab techs. "Miriam, please recover the ops download."
This time Mickey had no need to warn the SAIDs to be careful. The operation had taken on a sinister aura for every digital entity. Little was learned from the analysis of the ops download. In order not to repeat the exact process, Mickey had the SAIDs change out the warship's crystal to test another. The memory bank held 10 crystals. This time, the controller lasted almost an eighth of an hour before it was ruined. And so the process went. Pull the ops download, set up a new controller, trade out the Trident's crystal, and repeat. After the third controller was smoked, the team immediately began making new ones. Initially, they'd only prepared 10. After 2 days of testing and burning through 43 controllers, Mickey called a halt to the operations. Facing Miriam and the other SAIDs, he said, "I believe the way forward lies in the ops downloads. We've tested each of the Liberator's crystals 4 or more times. My question is, why did identically built controllers last different times before they overheated?" A tech returned the latest crystal to be tested to the bank's cradle. He waited until the tiny converter box from the Trident registered it was online. When the device signaled the crystal was operational, he noted the bank's capacity. Warned against using implants within the testing lab, the tech hurried over and tapped Mickey on the shoulder. "Sir, the converter box indicates the memory bank has lost nearly 2% of the data." Mickey was about to say impossible, but then again he was dealing with alien technology. Miriam said, "That explains the different controller burn times, Mickey. Conceivably, every time a crystal was reloaded, it had a little less data, and with a shift in the data stream, we experienced a shift in the burn times." Another SAID raised a finger to indicate he had a thought, but Mickey held up his hands. "Friends, let's vacate the lab to talk. I'd feel a great deal better if this lab was sealed while we conversed." "Now, please, Luther, continue," Mickey requested when they were outside.
"It occurs to me that we're observing two different forms of data, sir," Luther said. "The first form passes through the controller's circuitry without issue. Our device probably had relevant information stored for us before it was destroyed. The ops download indicates sampling and analysis was occurring. The second signal is an ephemeral stream that's destructive."
"Are you suggesting that this other form sat in the crystal, inert, as it were, until it had a target?" Mickey asked.
"Precisely," Luther replied.
Mickey had little reason not to pay attention to Luther. The SAID had worked for a Meridian house that was responsible for comm systems.
"There is another fact to consider, Mickey," Miriam said. "If we calculate the total amount of time the controllers were in operation and the rate at which they consumed data, the loss in crystal data is not equivalent, not even close."
Mickey examined the calculations Miriam passed the team. "This underscores Luther's reasoning. A virulent data form might be scattered throughout the broadcast. This is good news," Mickey said, clapping his hands in delight.
"'We await your insight, Mickey,' Miriam replied, placing her fists on her hips.
Mickey recognized Miriam's posture. She'd copied it from Pia, and it was equally effective for both females.
"'Sorry,' Mickey said contritely. "'What we have to do is separate or filter the real broadcast from this virulent data.'
"'Okay, Mickey, how?' Miriam asked.
"'Luther,' Mickey said, turning to the Sade with a hopeful look. It generated a round of chuckles, not the least of which was because Luther appeared as if he had been handed an explosive device to defuse without a manual.
"'This will require some thought, Mickey,' Luther replied, which was newly freed Sade speak for, "'I need a few moments while I enter a fugue and focus on my kernel's processing.'
Humans took the opportunity to grab a bite and a cup of tea. They had missed the midday meal. In the meantime, the Sades communed with Luther to offer their support. When Mickey, the engineers, and the techs returned, the Sades were nowhere in sight. Mickey pinged Miriam and located her in the assembly lab with the other Sades. The humans discovered the Sades furiously constructing a device, which was housed inside a large cabinet. Within an hour, the Sades completed their devices and carted them to the testing lab. The Sades set about hooking up two controllers in tandem. The first controller was also connected to the cabinet, and the second controller was connected to a fresh memory crystal bank. Finally, a squat-looking box was attached to the cabinet's output.
"'We're ready for the first warship crystal, Mickey,' Luther announced.
"'To quote Miriam,' Mickey replied, and placed his fists on his hips. Miriam laughed not only at Mickey's antics, but the confused expression on Luther's face.
"'Luther educated us on comm-filtering techniques,' Miriam explained. It occurred to several of us that we are dealing with a malevolent entity which seeks to destroy. Therefore, it was decided to emulate one of Alex's techniques.
"'Which is what, in this case?' Mickey prompted.
"'We will entice our adversary to make the first move and show its hand, Mickey. Whatever is buried throughout this broadcast data waits to attack sophisticated electronics. It's meant to cripple them,' Miriam replied.
"'Am I to understand that it's your plan to fool this dangerous stream into taking the path toward the cabinet?' Mickey asked. "'What's to prevent the broadcast data that we need from going the same direction?'
"'Digital gravity,' Luther replied. "'We've added a small interface at the front of the first controller. The broadcast data will pass through the interface and into the controller normally to be sampled and analyzed.' Then it will be sent to the second controller to be stored in the new memory crystal. However, the interface at the front of the first controller will offer the destructive signal a route toward a much more tempting target. We're confident the malevolent data can't resist our offer.
I feel like I'm listening to a director explain the concept for an ancient horror vid, Mickey replied. There's a great deal of equipment in that cabinet, Luther. Once a bit of Nual treachery gets in there, it's going to create a significant fire and probably destroy most of the lab.
Negative, sir, Luther explained. The cabinet is merely a delay device. It will add a significant amount of transmission time while the destructive data flows through it.
Then where's the bait? Mickey asked.
The temptation, Miriam replied, translating New Terran speak for Luther. Is in that small box, which is heavily fire-protected.
Curious, Mickey replied, examining the small enclosure. What would interest this ugly data more than a controller?
Embedded in the interface of the first controller is a set of algorithms, Mickey, which indicates a Sade's kernel is on the other end of the link, Miriam explained.
I'm confused, Mickey said. How does an empty kernel attract this data stream?
The Sades grew quiet, and Mickey looked at Miriam for an answer. It wouldn't, Mickey. The kernel isn't empty. It contains a copy of my kernel.
Mickey blanched, and he glanced at the other humans, who were as uncomfortable with the concept as he was. Miriam searched for a means of relieving the unease swirling through the humans' minds.
"I'm detecting some jealousy from the humans in this room," Miriam said.
"What?" Mickey asked in surprise.
"You heard me," Miriam repeated. "You're jealous that the Nual corruption stream finds Sades more desirable than mere humans."
First, a tech snickered, then a couple of engineers snorted, and soon humans and Sades were laughing.
"Pretty good one, Miriam," Mickey said. "Let's find out how tempting you are."
"That aspect of my persona is not to be doubted, Mickey," Miriam replied with a nice touch of hauteur. "What we must discover is how tempting I am to the Nual."
The engineering team wasn't required to run another 43 tests, but Miriam did have to copy her kernel 19 more times.
"Credit to Alex's foresight," Miriam said when the team saw the malevolent signal's definitive preference for a Sade kernel over a controller.
"And Alex protected you, Julian," Miriam thought with pride for the status that Sades held in Alex's world. That only 20 tests were required to run through the memory crystal's entire data was credited to the copies of Miriam's kernel fending off the initial attacks. The Sades reasoned that the kernel succumbed only after the attack of a multitude of virulent streams. When the filtering process was complete, the team supposed that they had acquired a new memory bank of untainted broadcast data. The warship's crystal bank indicated a loss of nearly a fifth of its original data total.
"A clever integration of weaponized signal broadcasting," Luther said admiringly. "I must consider a means of protecting our ships before they next meet the Nual."
Luther found humans staring at him with expressions ranging from concern to horror.
"That's an excellent idea, Luther," Mickey said, laying a hand on the Sade's shoulder. "We mere mortals would appreciate not being left to the mercy of the Nual when the Sades and our ship controllers become permanently inert."
"I will be diligent in my responsibilities, sir," Luther replied with gravity, failing to recognize Mickey's humor.
"Okay," Mickey said, clapping his hands enthusiastically. "I want to test our cleaned data, reconfigure the original setup. Let's pass the data from our second set of crystals through a new controller to a bank of clean crystals, and hope we don't produce a burned controller."
In little more than an hour, the entire trove of broadcast data was cleared by a single controller without a mishap.
"The data should be safe now," Mickey announced. "But there's to be no sampling of the data. Instead, we'll need some linguistic specialists to program a controller to decode the Nual broadcast."
"We have linguistic experts?" Luther asked.
"We have the next best thing, Luther," Mickey replied. "We have the Sades who deciphered the Sui Sui whistles and were some of the first to master the Dishnya language."
Chapter 33 Master Race. Alex convened a meeting in a Freedom conference room with Renee, Ellie, Mickey, Key Sades, and Yumi, who was surprised to have been invited.
"Mickey, you have the floor," Alex said to open the discussion.
Mickey walked everyone through what transpired in the Omnian lab. While it wasn't news to Renee or any Sade, Ellie and Yumi were particularly horrified by what had targeted their trident.
"What about the next time we meet the Nual?" Ellie asked.
"Luther?" Alex prompted.
"I haven't yet devised the exact method, Sayers, but it will be similar to what was accomplished in the lab. We can't afford to change out equipment as it's destroyed. It must be a permanent solution that filters their destructive streams from their broadcast," Luther explained.
"Won't the Nual change up their processes when they discover they're ineffective?" Ellie asked.
"Undoubtedly, Captain. I have considered that, which makes the design process ever more difficult. I must create a solution for today and one that anticipates what the Nual might do in the future.
I find the task challenging, to say the least. That I have so many of my kind to assist me makes me confident that we will be successful."
"I've every confidence that you will be, Luther," Alex said.
"Sir," Luther replied, nodding his head and touching hand to chest.
"Julian, you're next," Alex said.
Julian explained that the Sades weren't able to decipher the broadcast in its entirety. They lacked sufficient references to translate the language, but he considered the portions they had gleaned were worth sharing.
"We discovered that the broadcast repeated its message in several hundred languages," Julian said.
"Several hundred?" Yumi repeated in amazement.
"Gives you an idea of the number of races that the Nual might have conquered, Lieutenant," Alex said.
"We targeted one language in particular," Julian continued. "It had words that resembled Sui Sui terms. We, the Sades, believe that this particular portion of the broadcast was in the Nual language. Our familiarity with the Sui Sui terms of the Nual, such as World, Traveler, Star Hunter, and others, enabled us to tease out portions of the broadcast."
"What did you understand, Julian?" Ellie asked.
"One moment, Captain. There is more to comprehend regarding the origination of these signals," Julian said as politely as possible.
"What we wish to bring to this group's attention is that we're certain it was the Nual who were broadcasting to the Liberator. The carrier wave from the orb at the wall was the same technique used by the spheres and probes. However, in the case of our warship's comm station, obviously, the orb chose a method of transmission that it perceived we would be able to handle. How it determined that is a mystery to us."
"But it's one that I'm working on," Luther added. "The capture of the broadcast and the Trident's comm station logs are providing incredible insight into the Nual comm techniques.
We understand the Nual broadcast was a ruse while they bombarded our ship through their comm attack," Julian continued. "But they sought to present a real invitation in case their attack failed.
They were covering their bet, so to speak," Julian said, tipping his head to Alex.
"In their invitation's repetition, the Nual listed a series of proper names, which we understood to be the names of other races. And here's the critical point, Sayers. It's our belief that we were invited to speak with their masters, for lack of a better word, who these races serve."
"While you digest this idea," Alex said into the conversation that ensued from Julian's announcement, "I want to review the discussions I've had with several of you, but not with this group as a whole." The table's holovid sprang to life, and the various ships that the Omnians met at the wall were displayed.
"Z, your turn," Alex said.
"Pilot Yumi noted that I should examine the arrival of the ships at the wall," Z said. "Several of us have analyzed the ship's propulsion methods and noted significant variations. These differences indicate a lack of a single technologically homogeneous population. Also evident are the tremendous ship design variations," Miranda added. "Someone should help the poor dears coordinate. It would have been much more intimidating for them to have arrived at the wall displaying unique ship functionality while constructed on a similar design principle. It's our estimate that there were at least 11 unique races represented in the main fleet alone," Z said. "Surprisingly, the fighters didn't appear to resemble the carriers they exited."
"To sum it up," Alex said, clasping his hands in front of him, "the Nual, who we thought were intent on expansionism and wiping out any developing species, might be just lackeys who, along with other races, work for even worse entities." Yumi, who'd been ever more flummoxed as the information about the adversaries piled on, looked around the table. The concern of the faces of humans and Sades reflected her own.
"I know I'm speaking for myself," she said,
but I feel thoroughly intimidated. Defeating a sphere or two was one thing. Defeating a civilization composed of hundreds of races seems like a daunting task, if not impossible.
Undoubtedly, Lieutenant, Alex replied. He sat with his arms crossed and one hand rubbing his chin. If that was what you were trying to do...
It isn't what we're going to do? Yumi asked in confusion.
Z, Miranda, how different would you say these ships were from one another? Alex asked.
Technology hasn't been shared, Alex, Z replied. Propulsion gases indicate vast technological differences. It's evidence of species eons apart in technology.
Armament displays and ports speak to a variety of weapons among the different ships, Miranda commented.
It's a theme that echoes our analysis of the propulsion mechanisms. The older the drive techniques, the older the weapons.
And the small sphere, or orb as everyone calls it? Alex asked.
The most sophisticated of the ships, by far, Julian said.
I didn't recognize any of these ships as having a design similar to the bullet ships that the spheres carried. Did anyone else? Alex asked, and received a series of negative responses.
Does that make the 11 which were represented in the main party one greater?
Ellie asked.
Not necessarily, Captain, Z replied. It's conceivable the bullet ships are made by the master race for the Nual, who appear to operate as their envoys.
And exterminators, Renee added with disgust.
I'd like to return to the Lieutenant's question, Alex, Cordelia said. She thought defeating such a massive civilization of many races to be impossible, and you intimated that wasn't your intent.
What do you see, Commodore, when you observe multiple races who've probably been cobbled together for millenniums, but they haven't received the benefits of shared technology? Alex asked.
I don't see benevolence, Cordelia replied.
Just so, Alex agreed. I think the situation creates a short-term and a long-term goal for us. For our immediate future, we must claim our territory and send a message to the Nual and their masters.
The spheres, which are this side of the wall, Julian supplied.
Exactly, Alex replied. They're our targets and must be eliminated from this side of the wall.
How many were there? Ellie asked.
23, Captain, Julian replied.
Alex, it would take a force of 12 or more tridents loaded with travelers to adequately trap and take down each sphere, Ellie calculated.
Plus, we'd need to have competent commanders leading these fleets. We can't let the Meridians or New Terrans encounter a sphere by themselves.
That's not what I intend to do, Captain, Alex replied. I intend to send our entire force against the nearest sphere. It would be an excellent opportunity for the fleet to practice maneuvers.
And it would be extremely intimidating, Miranda added. I can just imagine the last message that will be sent by the sphere before it detonates.
Speaking of which, Renee interjected, how can the fleet be protected from a sphere's tendency to take ships with it when it explodes?
That will be an opportunity for the freedom, sir, Cordelia said.
Our orbital platform has been splitting production in half between fulfilling traveler orders from other worlds and providing the city ships with fighters. Z and Miranda have installed ancillary programs in every traveler, which will allow them to operate in concert, independent of the city ship's controller or a pilot's directions. We use these unmanned fighters to eliminate the bullet ships. Once the sphere is defenseless, we'll send the travelers in to close the cordon. Two or more of these automated fighters will attack and tempt the sphere to detonate.
Alex marveled at the authority and flexibility that the Sage had exhibited in his absence. His smile was wide and generous as he gazed across the table at Cordelia. Then he turned his admiring expression on Z and Miranda.
"My dear man, if I was capable of blushing, that expression would have elicited mine," Miranda sent.
Could we automate every traveler so that the lives of pilots won't be risked? Renee asked.
Unfortunately not, sir, Cordelia replied. These methods will work in simple scenarios where the travelers have a single target and a fairly simple purpose. In a full-scale operation, which would demand multiple maneuvers, there wouldn't be time to program and coordinate the fighters. Julian, if we were to prosecute the spheres one at a time, how long would it take the fleet to sail to the present locations of these 23 spheres? Yumi asked.
Julian blinked in the time it took him to calculate the distances between the stars where the spheres had been located, allowing for the shortest path to reach them.
I estimate the travel time to be about 14.5 years, Lieutenant, Julian replied.
Yumi's mouth fell open. Closing it, she said, "Plus time for in-system travel and the fights."
"Assuredly," Julian replied calmly.
He understood Yumi's concern. To hunt and destroy the spheres that had been located, she would give up more than 8% of her expected lifespan, if she survived. Sades would share the danger, but wouldn't fret the time.
"Lieutenant," Alex said calmly, "you're envisaging events as all or nothing. Things are seldom that way. Imagine you're the Nual who must answer to this master race. Your spheres are out among the stars, stamping out existing or potential spacefaring life forms. Recently, you've lost two spheres to some minor upstarts. It's worrying, but containable. Now, if in the course of less than a year you lose four or five more spheres, decisively, what would you do?"
"I would order the spheres to band together and travel as a squadron," Yumi said.
Then she corrected herself.
"No, that wouldn't work. Not with the size of the attacking fleet that the spheres would have reported before they detonated."
"No, I'd recall them," Yumi said. The smile on Alex's face told her that she'd reasoned correctly.
"That's how we'll claim our territory," Alex said, eyeing each member of the table.
"The probes, Alex," Julian said. "Therese said she was considering abandoning the Herrican carriers."
"And?" Alex said.
"We use the carriers to eliminate the probes. Load them with banishers and a few travelers for protection," Julian replied.
Alex started to ask a question but stopped. Instead, he grinned and said, "Brilliant, Julian. Will it require new equipment on the bridge or merely programming for the controllers?"
"For the rest of us, Alex," Renee interjected.
"Julian, it's your idea. Go ahead," Alex offered.
"We automate the carriers," Julian explained, "adding functions for defense of the ship and offense against the probes with the banishers. In the event a carrier encounters significant forces, it abandons the system and moves on to the next one."
"What about reaction mass, emergency repairs, or running low on banishers or travelers?" Ellie asked.
"For the most part, Captain, these are all programmable events," Julian replied. "In regard to reaction mass, your concern is noted. The carrier has a great number of bays that won't be in use. We can add additional tanks there, and it might be prudent to set a date by which the carriers return to us for service."
"Essentially, we'd set up the carriers to eliminate the probes, system by system, without involving our warships or crews," Alex allowed. "And President Lachaud will love the idea of putting the carriers to such a valuable use as opposed to scrapping the ships."
"After we've hunted the spheres and forced them to retreat to their territory, do we intend it to return to the wall?" Ellie asked.
"Do what?" Yumi asked with trepidation.
"We certainly can't hope for detente," Alex replied. "Our grav drives weren't displayed to the ships at the wall, but probes have reported our ship movements in multiple worlds. The Master Race knows of our growing capabilities. I believe that an intelligent species that has lived for millenniums, maybe eons, under a mantra of expansionism, can't imagine existing any other way. If we pause and hope for peace, they'll be using the time to conceive of a means of eliminating us."
Then what's our long-term goal? Ellie asked.
After we've sent the carriers to destroy the probes, eliminated a few spheres, and seen the spheres fleeing to the other side of the wall, we'll need to confront this civilization, Alex replied.
And how are you proposing to do that?